And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
Hold on a second.
There's no reason to get back and go back and forth and be in this aggressive way.
Miffed around here about how information's been shared with the press corps about here.
Yeah, things are getting hot. Chaos in the White House briefing room as the president's spokesperson is called out for essentially lying about the president's condition. We're going to have it for you. We're going to play it for you. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. All right, I know. We're going to start with something a little different. I want to show you something. And I'm going to show you some images here. And I hate the fact that I have to constantly say this before I show images like this, but it's important. These are images that my fellow Americans here will probably never see because here in this country, my colleagues in the media have simply decided that for some reason they can't show you something like this. They will never show video that in any way humanizes Russia or the Russian people or the Russian president. But here's the video. It's no big deal. It's just, it's President Putin giving a tour of his home to India's President Modi. Here it is. Look at the video. Again, I mean, here's Modi leaving his limo, coming up and shaking hands with the president of Russia. Now, India and Russia, to hear Indian officials describe it, have like this 75-year relationship that is not going to be stopped simply because some people in Washington don't like the fact that they're friends. That's what Indian officials say, by the way, and they're probably right. The U.S. State Department spokesperson said last night that he's concerned about India's president meeting with Russia's leader. I should note that one of the most important reasons why Modi is meeting with Putin is to hash out ways to try and settle the Ukraine conflict. And interestingly enough, this is important, interestingly enough, that is something that Western leaders, with the exception of a few like maybe Hungary's Viktor Orban, have not been willing to do. In fact, they haven't even included Russia in any of the peace talks. And when there have been potential deals, they've sabotaged them. Think about that. So now they're mad because these guys are talking about a potential peace deal? Anyway, by the way, there is an ample community of people from India, by the way, who are now citizens living in Russia. And yesterday, I thought you'd find this interesting. Here's Mr. Modi paying some of them a visit. Yeah, this is pretty cool, isn't it? 14,000 of them or so just in and around Moscow, extremely enthusiastic about Modi's visit. And again, Modi's government has established some extremely close economic ties with Russia. I mean, if you think about this, they import 2.1 million barrels a day of Russian oil. And here's what makes this even more important as we watch this video. Since the war in Ukraine, India imports from the U.S. have been downgraded by more than 70%, while imports from Russia are up 25%, right? And that's the ended up improving the economic situations of both countries. And again, that's probably something that does not make some folks in Washington happy. Then there's another video I found that I wanted to show you because there's something that's almost amusing about this guy Modi, right? The Modi mystique, if you want to call it. Just watch this. I don't know about you, but I thought that was kind of cool. Manila, as I'm looking at that, I'm thinking, who is this guy, Elvis? I mean, he's got everybody cheering him on and stuff. But listen, all kidding aside, this is an important global story. What a shame that the U.S. media is basically ignoring it.
Yeah, those women, Rick, were giddy like schoolgirls. It was kind of cute, kind of funny to see over
they were.
Modi. He got the rock star treatment. But Rick, you know, I'm super surprised. I mean, wait, Vladimir Putin doesn't live in a lair on the side of a mountain or something like Dr. Evil?
Right.
He has a ranch with horses? Like, what? Hold on. And then, you know, Dmitry Peskov, and I think he rightly said so yesterday, yeah. Dmitry Peskov said that Washington is simply jealous of Modi's visit to Russia and the friendly relations. Although we should note, Modi's previous presidential visit here to the U.S. During Biden's term, I think it was about a year or so ago, President Modi, believe it or not, actually hosted and led a yoga session on the National Mall.
There you go.
He got some rock star treatment here as well. But the story of the Russian-Indian friendship, I think, is ignored largely because it shows a narrative that's unflattering to the U.S.,
yep.
that Russia is not isolated in the world as the narrative has been for the last 2 years. And I think this is very clearly evidence of that.
And I'm just looking at the video and comparing my ranch to Mr. Putin's, by the way. I have horses, I have golf carts, you know, and but I don't think I'm in as good a shape as he is, so we'll just leave it at that. By the way, I there's another head-shaking story today that I have to share with you, and this moves us out of the, you know, Russia-India sphere, or maybe it doesn't. And here it is. It seems to be making liars out of the president's staff. This happened overnight. It broke yesterday after you and I were done with yesterday's show. The New York Times, to their credit, by the way, broke the story yesterday that according to White House logs that check people in and out when they come in and out of the White House, a neurologist who's an expert in Parkinson's has visited the White House once a month, every month, for the past 8 months. Who knew, right? But watch what happens when Karine Jean-Pierre, the spokesperson for the White House, is asked about this report.
So every year, around the president's physical examination, he sees a neurologist. That's three times, right? So I am telling you that he has seen a neurologist three times while he has been in this presidency. That's
you
what I'm saying.
White House or Walker
Reed? I am telling you that he has seen them three times. For security reasons, we cannot share names. We cannot share names.
Others he would have met with.
We cannot share names of specialists broadly, from a dermatologist to a neurologist. We cannot share names. There are security reasons. We have to protect.
Hold on a second.
There's no reason to get back and go back and forth and be in this aggressive way.
We missed around here about how information's been shared with the press corps about him.
What do you missed about?
Everything is asked about.
And then every time I come back and I answer the question that you guys asked.
Correctly, you didn't have to come back and clean it up.
I never answered the question incorrectly.
Yeah, he can't share his name unless, of course, it's somebody who has good stuff to say about the president. Then we'd give you his name, his address, his phone number, and his credit cards if we could. And Manila, I'm watching this, and as a reporter, I mean, I did what those guys are doing there for many years, working, as you know, at CNN and NBC and Fox, and I'm telling you, my BS detector's like going, woo, 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 woo. It is so obvious that she's lying.
Well, yes, I mean, Rick, part and parcel of her job is to run cover for the White House. And unfortunately, increasingly over the years, that has become the role of the White House press secretary instead of actually conveying the full and forthright information to the press. Now, Ed O'Keefe, he's usually very mild-mannered.
Yes.
He's a very nice man. I've bumped into him a couple of times. I've never seen him get that testy. So for it to come from CBS's Ed O'Keefe, that says a lot. But, you know, the response coming from Karine Jean-Pierre, I think she was quite shocked that it came from him, because normally she gets pestered with questions and peppered by Peter Ducey from Fox. But for it to come from Ed and to have it get that testy, that explains a lot about what's actually going on behind the scenes.
It's basic math. I mean, how did she get 3 out of 8? If there are logs that show a neurologist, specialist in Parkinson's, went to the White House, met with the president's doctor at least on one occasion, and was there 8 times, and then she sits there and says, no, according to my records, they only saw him 3 times. Well, how do you get 3 out of 8? This is math. I'm sorry, but it's frustrating.
Math is not my forte either,
Me neither. I'm a writer. Me neither. All right, so here's the situation. Now, the president appears to be seeing a Parkinson's expert, as we just learned, even though they're denying it. Well, the vice president, Kamala Harris, appears to be in La La Land. This is a spoof that was brought to my attention by none other than Manila, It was prepared, by the way, by Comedy Central. Here it is. I want to share it with you.
Talking about the significance of the passage of time, right? The significance of the passage of time. So when you think about it, there is great significance to the passage of time.
Seems like maybe it's a small issue, it's a big issue. You need to get to go and need to be able to get where you need to go to do the work and get home.
It is time for us to do what we have been doing, and that time is every day.
Every day it is time for us to agree that...
She's come so far since our first session.
I lead the vice president on not so much sentences as idea voyages.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
Think in the context of all in which you live and what came before you. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, what the hell is she talking about?
Well, Rick, first, let me get you up to speed. I am a Los Angeles native, okay, where all this yoga, hippy-dippy, crunchy mumbo-jumbo originated. And I have been immersed in that world where there are different spiritual leaders, they call themselves, or, you know, thought leaders in that community that really do speak like that. So that's why that joke was so funny to me when I saw it. Okay. And I had to wonder, holy cow, does Kamala Harris really have like some yogi person that's kind of walking her through on how to approach foreign policy and diplomacy? Because how else would we explain that unless the neurologist specialist that's going to the White House is helping her too?
Well, listen, if she was into this yogi, hippy, dippy, whatever you call it, that maybe they do somewhere in California, that's fine, as long as we also had a matching soundbite of her explaining public policy at some point in some cogent fashion. But since I've never seen that, I think because it doesn't exist, this is all we got. And it's frightening to me, and it should be to most Americans. I mean, wow.
It's new age, Rick. Yeah. New age. Crunchy stuff. You got to take a trip to California and then you'll understand.
Yeah, I'm too old and too East Coast, I guess. It's great. Thanks, Manila. Thanks for sharing that, by the way. I thought it was pretty amazing. When we come back, another new age guy, Dan Kovalik, is going to be joining us. He's written a new book, by the way. It's called The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Dan is going to be joining us. There you see his smiling face. We'll be talking to Dan when we come back. You stay right there.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. On this glorious day, let me read you something. Ready? It goes like this. Defenders of Israel would like us to believe that the creation of Israel was a peaceful process on a barely populated land. However, this is far from the truth. Rather, the creation of Israel was accompanied by a Nakba, a catastrophe for the people of Palestine. Once again, that's a description of the book that's called The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. And the man who wrote that is Dan Kovalik, who's good enough to join us now to talk about this. I hope you're not insulted when I called you a new age guy, Dan. I don't know whether you
insulted.
Are.
I was at one point. I went through a new age period, so it's okay.
So let's talk about your book. The fascination around the world with what's happening in Gaza is amazing. I even read some numbers today that the situation in Gaza is much more dire than we have been reporting. I mean, the number that's being used here in the United States by the media is generally maybe 30,000 people have been killed, maybe 35, maybe as much as 40. I'm hearing it could be nearing 100,000. That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, the Lancet, the very well-respected Lancet, I believe out of Great Britain, is estimating that 186,000 people in Gaza have been killed.
Good God.
Which is about 8% of the population of Gaza. And that number is going to climb, Rick, very quickly. I mean, the famine is setting in. You're seeing photos of children emaciated. I have friends in Gaza, you know, who have no access to food, no access to water. So those numbers are terrible. They're going to climb. They're going to get worse. And it's something we need to focus on because the U.S. is providing critical support to this.
What is the case for Palestine then, as you see it? I mean, I was out playing golf this weekend with some buddies, and I heard them saying things that were not very kind about Palestine's situation or the Palestinian situation. And they seem to be saying, well, they're kind of getting what they deserve because they struck first. They attacked, right, on October 7th. So what is the case for them?
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, that claim, which is a common claim, it basically ignores what happened for decades before October 7th, including, as you mentioned, the Nakba of 1948, in which 750,000 Palestinians were displaced, thousands others killed in the creation of Israel, which was created on a land occupied by the Palestinian people for centuries. Mm-hmm. And again, that's a fact that Israelis and their supporters want to deny, but it's a fact. And Israel only went on to forcibly take more land to occupy both Gaza and the West Bank. And then around 2008, 2009, Israel left Gaza. But what it did is it surrounded it with fences. It determined how much food and water got in and electricity got into Gaza. In fact, in terms of the food, the Israelis calculated how many calories were necessary per person to keep the people of Gaza alive and guaranteed that they got just under that. To the point where in 2018, the UN said that Gaza would be unlivable by 2020. That was 4 years ago. And so that all has to be taken into account when you look at what happened on October 7th. Already, Israel had made Gaza an unlivable place.
So if you're saying that, let me tell you about a comparison that I've read a lot about that people often make. People will say that what happened on October 7th was akin to what slaves and their revolts that occurred, like the famous revolt in Haiti, for example, that we know very well in our hemisphere. Some of the slave revolts that took place in the United States when people who felt like they were oppressed, enslaved, finally fought back. And they're saying that's all that really was. I'm not defending it, and I'm certainly not defending the killing innocent people like what happened on that day. But can that case be made?
Of course it can. And I do make it in the book. And actually, I quote a Jewish intellectual in it who also compares it to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising against the Nazis. Because, in fact, again, before October 7th, Israel had really effectively made Gaza into a concentration camp. And so, yes, I think it can be compared to all those things. And by the way, we also have to acknowledge what Haaretz is finally, the Israeli paper is finally acknowledging in English, and that is that it looks like it's possible Israel killed more Israelis on October 7th than Hamas did because they ordered the Hannibal directive, which was to kill Israelis if it looked like they might be taken as hostage. So that's a whole other thing to think about. But even putting that aside, yes, this is like a slave revolt. This is like, frankly, the attacks that John Brown made in trying to end slavery.
So if that's the case, and I think here's another point that I've heard made, and I'm wondering how you're going to react to this. I've often heard asked recently by some intellectuals, What really happened was there was a certain amount of guilt, especially after World War II, given what Europeans had done to the Jews, which was phenomenally abominable. It was horrible. I mean, and there's no question about it. But rather than then say, we did this, we should make a space for you because you deserve it, they said, we did this, but the Palestinians and the Arabs are going to make a place for you, not us. Even though, and I think there's an irony here from my reading, the Palestinians and the Jews in that area for centuries got along magnificently. The Palestinians never mistreated the Jews. The Europeans did, but the Europeans chose to make the Palestinians pay for their crime, essentially, right? For their sins. What did I get wrong?
Yes. No, you got it perfectly right. First of all, though, it needs to be pointed out that the plans to create Israel were made in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration.
Correct.
Where Britain already announced that Israel would be created as a homeland for the Jews. And that's important because that predates the Holocaust by many decades. At that point, World War I wasn't even over, right? Mm-hmm. Much less the beginning of World War II. But you're right. Ultimately, the UN issued a resolution calling for the creation of Israel in 1948 after the Holocaust, clearly in reaction to it. And again, totally understandable, given the terrible things that were done to the Jews, which all of us have to recognize, and I certainly recognize. But you don't solve a crime like that by committing a crime against other people, a very similar crime. And as you mentioned, it ignores the fact that it was Germany that committed that crime.
Right.
Germany has never paid for that crime. Instead, the Palestinian people were made to pay for that crime and continue to.
Mm-hmm.
And not only are they saddled with having to pay for it, in a strange way, they're even saddled with the guilt. That somehow there's this almost weird thought processing in which the Palestinians are blamed for the Holocaust, which they had nothing to do with.
You know,
so it is this strange mental gymnastics happening.
You know, there's this term that guys like you and I use all the time when we have these conversations, is that we live in this 48-hour news cycle. And for the Palestinians, for example, and for many Israelis who, it's not their fault. They imagine an Israeli child who was born 16, 17, 18 years ago. All he knows is he's grown up in a place where he's constantly being told the Palestinians want to kill you, the Palestinians want to destroy you. A bunch of Arab countries say you don't deserve to live. So they grow up thinking those people are my enemy and I can't ever accept them. So everything is contextual, right? And even the people we think may be wrong in this case, are they really that wrong? This gets so confusing, Dan.
Well, I think they are wrong. And I think, first of all, it has to be pointed out that the Palestinians, most Palestinians are accepting of Jews, have always been accepting of Jews, do not want to kill Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
They do want their land back. And by the way, the UN has passed numerous resolutions saying Palestinians have a right of return to their land, to their homes. But yes, what I think has happened in Israeli society is they've convinced themselves that the Palestinians represent an existential threat to
yes.
them, and that therefore they have a right to wipe them out. When in fact, when you look at the facts,
right.
in every conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians, about 100 times more Palestinians will be killed than Israelis. And that's true right now, right? That's happening right now. And so the existential threat is really to the Palestinians. But yes, the Israelis have convinced themselves in large sectors of the world that they are the ones under existential threat, when in fact, that's not really the case.
We have a minute left. Sans his mental and physical problems, do you think the way Mr. Biden has prosecuted this situation in Gaza will also lead to his demise as the president or as a candidate for the presidency?
I think there's a good chance it will, and I think his administration knows that. The last poll I saw was that only 18% of Democrats supported this war in Gaza. I mean, it's a very small amount. And he is losing his base, especially amongst young people. Certainly what he's going to have is a deficit of enthusiasm for him at the polls, and he will need that to beat Trump. So I think this could lead to his demise, no question.
Yeah, the explanation of what is essentially the case for Palestine, something that is totally ignored in the Western media. And here you have Dan Kovalik say, I'm writing a book and I'm going to explain to people exactly what it is. Thanks for doing that, Dan, and thanks for sharing your insight into this story for us that is seen differently from a global perspective than it is from a Western perspective. Completely differently, I should say. Thanks again.
Thank you, Rick. Really appreciate you.
That's our show. Remember always to be looking outside your own box. Truths, they don't live in boxes. That's why we try to do this newscast the way we do. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll be looking for you again next time.